Gosh, John, I forget how good you are at karate. That's incredible.
I know, man. I mean, it's all about the right belt.
It is. Timing, you know? Or your leather belt.
Exactly.
I feel like maybe, is that not, that's what you meant?
Not really, okay. But speaking of, Dave, wow, I'm just going to try to transition to save you. Finally, Dave.
Yeah.
Warm spring days are arriving.
Oh,
am I right?
Isn't it great? You know what? I need a new pair of shades that I don't have to baby. Do you know what I'm saying, John? I don't want to take care of them. Let me put them on, take them off, and not have to worry about
them. Hey, Dave, I know exactly
what you mean. Sorry, I didn't mean to rant.
Knock around is the solution. They've been making high-quality shades that don't break the bank since 2005.
Oh, wow.
And they've actually been my personal go-tos for years.
Oh, yeah. I love Knock Around, John. They have over 20 different frame styles, so there's something for everyone, including tons of kids' pairs.
That's right. So whether you're looking to rep your favorite sports teams, you know, like you're a sports guy, spend some relaxation time in the yard, or cruise down Broadway with the windows down like Dave does all the time.
All the time.
Every Tuesday and Thursday and Saturday. Knock Around, that's what you need.
Yeah. All of their lenses have UV 400 protection, which is basically like sunscreen for your eyes, which, by the way, I've tried that and it hurts. Use the sunglasses, everybody. With polarized adult pairs starting at $28, you can get a few pairs to leave in your car, toss in your beach bag, or lend to a friend in need.
Dave, that is such a good price that I might buy a pair just to intentionally lose them.
I don't love that logic, John, but
I know,
you do have a history of misplacement. It's Knock Around.
Don't fight me because of the karate stuff.
But it could be perfect for you.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So, Dadville fans, don't squint through family beach days or trips to the park. Check out knockaround.com and use the promo code DADVILLE15 for 15% off your order.
That's DADVILLE15 for 15% off your order at knockaround.com.
Dave, listen, before we start this episode of Dadville, I want to share something with you that has completely changed my life. You ready?
Yeah.
Two words.
Okay. Our friendship.
Friendship, yeah. Okay, so there are two things that have changed my life.
Okay.
That's number one.
Oh, thank you.
Number two, methodical coffee.
Ooh.
I'm drinking it right now.
Can
you
I try that?
It?
Yeah. Oh, wow. A little tear. Ooh, that got me. Jeez.
I teared up my first time, too. Mm. It's now my go-to coffee.
Should be.
Methodical roasts their coffee to best express the life it lived, right? The place, the weather, the soil, and to honor the skilled people who cultivated it.
I feel like when I taste it, I can it's hard to explain. It's that it's like I'm sitting on a beach.
Right.
A beautiful sunrise.
I'm with you.
And there's rolling waves.
Yep.
There's a little dolphin that just jumped out of the water named Carlos. He's winking.
Yep.
And when he winks, something in me knows goodness.
And Carlos is drinking the coffee, too.
Yeah, well, that's assumed, of course. Yeah. With his little fin.
So Methodical offers a wide variety of flavor profiles. They range from like the classics that are bold and chocolatey. They got contemporary that are medium bodied, you know, and fruity.
Ooh, okay.
All the way to the avant-garde, you know, that pushes the envelope.
Yeah, that's I want that. Let's get weird in here. Well, you can tell Methodical must roast coffee to order because those feel like the freshest beans possible.
Oh, they are. So visit methodicalcoffee.com for more information. You can use the discount code DADVILLE for 10% off your first order.
Doing it right now because I need to start my day off with that cup of coffee every day. That's methodicalcoffee.com.
And don't forget the discount code DADVILLE. Dadville.
Here we go.
Okay, no more joking around.
No more joking around. Actually, just a lot of joking around now. So we're excited today here on Dadville. One of our guests who lives probably feet away from both.
An esteemed colleague.
A member now twice. He has two tickets into Dadville with two kids, which is and the new one's like she's still young, right, Matt?
I think so, yeah. She's like 10 months, I think. 10 months. 10, 11, 10 months. 10 months.
Oh, that's maybe the best start to a dad role we've ever had.
10 months in 3 days, actually.
Well, you came in.
Oh, there you go.
That was the fix.
Way to save that.
So this is a fun one. So, Matt has, Mr. Matt Carney, who's our guest today, he's already been referenced in the podcast, which kind of started a little bit of a turf war here in 12 South. There was some beef. There was some beef that was happening. There was some gangs that were starting getting.
It was kind of our first Dadville drama. Hopefully not the last.
Hashtag Dadville drama. We referenced Matt in that
one of Matt's sort of like spiritual gifts is how he always looks cool. And John and I feel a very kindred spirit between the both of us that we do not always feel cool.
Well, and there's a lot of emotions that it brings about in my heart, because there's intimidation there, but there's also inspiration. And I think it was Rector's interview.
There's a fine line between those two.
It's basically the same thing. They're becoming the same thing. We had our interview with Ben Rector, and we were talking about how we just don't, we've almost just let ourselves completely go. And I said, the only times that I really get it together is when I run into Matt Carney at a coffee shop here in our neighborhood. That happens, thankfully, for my wardrobe. It happens pretty often. And then for the next 48 to 72 hours, I really get it together. I might even go to Zara.com for a second. And then it just falls off.
Bro, I mean, Zara, that's an interesting move. I like that.
John, you're probably thinking, oh, I haven't been to Zara.com since 1998. But that's where you are, John.
I don't do .com well, any of it, actually.
See, that's the secret, isn't it?
Your .org? Only .org?
Yes, only .gov, really, actually, is my...
/edu. So so this is one of the reasons that we're excited. You know, there's a lot of reasons we're excited Matt's with us today. And that'll unfold as the episode does. What we always start with, Matt, I know you've listened to every single one of our podcasts, so you're just, you know how this goes. But what we like to do is kind of, we start with what we call our brag sheet, because it's just fun to sort of dwell on the accomplishments of our guests and just amazing things all you guys have done. So I'm going to read them off, and you might want to buckle up, because this is going to be a good slice of whatever the opposite of humble pie is. Proud pie? Can we start a band called Proud Pie?
Proud Pie.
And it's got to be funky. Okay. So Matt Carney, here we go. 1.6 million albums sold. And I want to tell you too. Yeah. So here's what's funny is
what is news to you.
you would be amazed how this, we do this with every guest in the music world.
Is this like when you go to networth.com, it's like totally accurate.
Network.
That's where we get all our info. That's where we get all our questions too.
Well, here's what's fun is they actually have pluses in front of it. So it's not, it's like they're even flexing on like, it could be more than this. Okay, so 1.6 million albums sold, 2.5 billion global streams. That's with a B, folks. 517 million on-demand streams, 2.8 billion with a B, AirPlay audience, 1.6 million social audience. I mean, that's like when I say that, Matt, how do you feel? Like what hits you when I say that?
I feel like there should be an asterisk by some of those stats, actually, because I don't know if they're correct. That seems like a lot. But
well, here's the thing. There should be an asterisk next to 1.6 million albums sold. And then you go to the bottom of the page and it said the equivalent of 1.6 albums sold in 2021 is like 50 billion albums sold in 1985.
Yeah, that's true.
That's what the asterisk would say.
And if you compare it to NSYNC's heyday, it's like four albums. It doesn't even matter. If it was 2007, no. That's crazy to hear. I mean, I can't believe my last job was Starbucks. So every day I get to do this seems like some crazy ride that I am incredibly lucky to still be able to do.
Yeah, I think that's why, I mean, I can't speak for John. I think that's one of the reasons I love reading that as the first thing. One, because I think for anyone that doesn't know who any of you guys are, it's a fun little like, oh. But I think too, that is always the response. I think everybody sort of goes like, whoa, that's, you know, like, I don't know that we've read it once and anybody been like, yeah, I mean, actually, some of those numbers need to be updated.
Actually.
You know,
that was 2017. Yeah. Okay. It's more now.
Yeah. Well, so one of the things I wanted to kind of start with is I don't know if you remember this. I think the first time that we ever like got a ticket to Kick It, I think Ed and I were working on one of my records, Cash, and we were in Cool Springs.
Whoa. Wait. Okay.
I'll even go as far as we had just eaten at Genghis Grill.
Bro, you were in that car. That was the fateful day.
So
that was
like
a very monumental day in my life, actually.
So you and I knew each other like in passing, like everybody, but I think you were new to town. I'd only been here a couple years.
I don't think we knew each other. I think I just heard of you. I was like a fan of you. And I was like, hey man, maybe we knew like
I think there was the others. And so I think Ed and I had either gotten through eating or we were going in to eat or something. And you were there. I think you were by yourself.
Yep.
And so we start talking. You're like, well, man, I got some mixes. And we were like, yes. And dude, I remember, I'm not saying this just to blow your head up, but I remember sitting in that car and you played Trainwreck for us. And I maybe like a couple other tunes you may have played. I can't remember what you played, but I know it was like a couple songs. And I remember hearing that song and thinking, this is one of the coolest just things I've ever heard. Cause it was like, you know, the spoken word with the choruses that were sung and that track, I remember made you laugh. I remember we talked about this like a decade ago. Cause I actually like hit you up and was like, dude, I can't find that song. And you were like, yeah, I think it's like gone away. And I was like, well, no, it doesn't need to go away. Cause it wasn't it like a bonus song or it was on your first record before you got signed. And then you got signed and
yes.
Something like that.
And I didn't like that song for a while, so I removed it off of actually Nothing.
That's what it was.
Nothing Left to Lose, which was the kind of like became a culmination of this independent record we had done that was what you were hearing. And then Right. That kind of got me signed. And then we wrote some new songs, and that became my first record. And weirdly, I wasn't into Trainwreck at that moment. And then, but I actually was listening to the other day. It's good. I should put that.
It's, dude, it's so good. I can't tell you how good that song. But anyway, I just remember like meeting you. It was such a fun hang. And then I remember this one of my favorite moments. We get back, and this is such an Ed Cash moment because he was like, dude, how great was that? And he goes, that I think I got to buy one of those. But would you find out what a chord that was? Because
yes.
That's the best sounding system I've ever heard in my life. Like he talked about that sound system for like five minutes.
That's what I remember. So that was such a vivid memory to me because Genghis Grill was amazing. You could get whatever you wanted in a bowl. But honestly, I remember sitting in the parking lot and that was, so that was a season of my life when I had, made an independent record and we had spent like $20,000 to us was like a massive deal. It was like this big investment. And I remember sitting in the car and that was back when I was very audaciously like, want to hear my demos? I probably was playing. I was like, come out to my car. Let me play
you
my record.
Yes.
Which
I've told my daughters, if anyone ever says that to you, you run.
Yes. Yeah, right.
It's all about context.
Want to come hear my demos?
And I remember clearly. Ed kept saying, "Like, is this just like a normal Honda Accord stereo? Like, did you?" And I was like, "He's like, are these like stock speakers?" Which was a compliment, especially to Robert, the guy I was working on, because he's such a good mixer. He mixed my whole new record, and but no, it was very vivid because that honestly, I remember Wurtz. Heard some of it through that moment. And then he passed it on to Scott Clayton at CAA or Tim Beating at CAA.
Yep.
He passed it on to Scott Clayton. And that was literally that car was like the beginning of my trajectory in any sort of like business sense of having industry people. Cause it basically ultimately got me signed to Aware Records. And it was literally that car ride and that, that listening party.
Well, if you had been in a Toyota Camry,
it would have been
maybe strange. Never would have happened for you.
All I want to see, Matt, is that your next tour is sponsored by Honda. They're like, we heard your story on Deadville and we're sending you a flock of Hondas.
Whatever their stereos are called.
Yeah. But you know, it's so funny. I love how you said that. I think that's one of my favorite things about living in this town. Is just all of us are so simpatico. Like it's just everybody's this soup that sort of gets mixed together and all of our stories are always somehow intertwined. And I love that about this town. I mean, I was the same as you, you know, I still do this. Like I think maybe a year ago I gave a CD to somebody somewhere, like literally and 41 years old. I think I saw somebody at a restaurant. I was like, dude, that's so-and-so. And I mean, I'm still doing that. You know what I mean? It's like, and if you hadn't done that, we'd have never sat in that car. So it's fun having you here. So, you know, we'd like to take it back. We like to take it back to the old school. So this is one thing I'm kind of fascinated about you. I don't know many people from the Northwest. I just don't. It's like when I meet people who are like, no, I like grew up in Seattle, grew up in Portland, I grew up in Eugene. I really feel like you just have to tell, like, just talk about that for a while. But you're from Eugene.
Yes, Eugene, Oregon.
And you lived there until you. I love you threw that in. And then you were there until. I mean, you did school. You did college, which we'll talk about in a second. But that's where you were from until here.
Yes.
Okay. So what was it? What is it like growing up in Oregon? Like what was your family like? Like what was sort of like, you know, what's the vibe?
Well, I mean, I'm a sixth generation Oregonian. So on my mother's side, yeah, they were like settlers, you know, covered wagon. We played Oregon Trail as a kid. That was my family. We actually have a journal from them traveling across the country. And like,
holy cow,
one of the brothers traded his sisters to like Native American for a horse for her, and they had to go back and like get her. And like, he got whipped by his dad, like literally.
I would hope so.
Yeah, he got whipped, is what they said. And then
they
went and settled in Portland, which was really cool, outside of Portland.
Oh, so they didn't go to Eugene?
No, they were in Portland. Yeah, they were like up somewhere north, like around Portland. And then eventually my mom grew up in Ashland or Medford, Oregon, which is in Southern Oregon. So through those six generations, they end up down there. And then my parents got married in Hawaii, barefoot on the beach, which that's another story. after like they had known each other for 4 weeks. And they moved up to Eugene. And that's kind of, my dad was like a hippie-ish guy, but he had also gone to law school, and he started his practice in Eugene. And yeah, so I grew up in Eugene, Oregon, which is like a great little 200,000 person town. University of Oregon's there.
Nike.
Yeah, Nike started there. That is true. Yeah.
I mean, is that being from there, is Nike, because is Nike still there?
Yeah. Well, Nike's world headquarters are in Portland, but yeah, Nike started on the track in Eugene, Oregon, where Bill Bowerman and Phil Knight started making shoes with waffle irons, and they just started putting them on the University of Oregon track team. They started making just custom shoes for them. And Phil Knight was a Tiger rep for those shoes, and he started using his channels of Tiger to like start making Nike's Tigers, bro. And so Nike's deeply a part of Eugene's culture and running and yeah, that whole thing.
Yeah. But like you didn't grow up with a bunch of Nike kid, like employees' kids, because that would have all been in Portland at that point.
Yeah, they would have moved to Portland. But I grew up with a lot of friends who like the Jacobas were like the first lawyer for them. So they're, you know, set for multi-generations. Yeah. So there was definitely like friends that went back maybe a couple of generations, like that when they were starting the shoes, those people and those families.
So what was your family like? Like what were the carnies like growing up?
My parents were interesting. You know, they like my
I feel like the fact that your dad was a hippie with a law degree, that is the Northwest.
Yeah, that sums it up.
That sums it up. It's like hippie-ish, but we've got a law degree.
Well, and he was from my dad was from Rochester, New York originally. And I actually wrote a song about it called Rochester, which is one of my favorite songs I've ever written. But it's like his story. He basically grew up in a super rough family, somehow ended up in the army, and then followed Pink Floyd through Europe for a while.
No way.
And then heard, like he said, almost an audible voice one day. He was instantly sober. He'd been high for like months. He was like instantly sober. It said, go home, get a job, get married. And he sold some like camera lenses, flew home back to Rochester, and he met a guy who said, hey man, if you come to Hawaii, I will give you a job. And before that, he had gone to UNLV, and when he got out of the army, he went to UNLV on a golf scholarship, got his law degree. Then he went over to Europe, followed Pink Floyd forever. And a guy said, hey, if you come to Hawaii, I'll give you a job. So he wasn't quite ready to settle down, but he flew from Europe to Hawaii. And
that's also another thing that I've told my daughters to run. If someone's like, hey, you fly to Hawaii, I'll give you a job.
Yeah, right?
Run.
He was a deckhand on a snorkel boat, actually. So he was like, you know, the guy, if you've ever been on a snorkel boat where they like do the cruises, and there's the guy that's like telling the jokes, and he's like, here's how you wash your glasses, and you spit in them, and then you rub the thing, you know, like, but he's got like one-liners for everything. That was my dad.
Yeah.
And he would lead kind of the tourists around the reef. And,
oh, please tell me that's how I met your mom. Please, please.
So
please.
One day this lady walked down the pier who was a mermaid on a glass bottom boat.
This whole thing sounds like a Farrelly Brothers movie.
I know. It is not fiction. and my mom, my mom's parents had gotten a divorce, and she took off to go to Hawaii, and she got a job as a mermaid on a glass bottom boat, which meant so the boat goes over the reef, and she would swim under and like do the hula as like the tourists were like looking down at the reef. She'd hold up like a starfish and be like,
"This is unbelievable."
And they one day crossed paths, and they had a mutual friend, and some guy's like, "Hey, this is Shannon." And my dad literally said to himself, "That's the woman you're going to marry." And they were engaged 4 weeks later and married 6 weeks later on the beach in Hawaii. And yeah.
That was the first time that he saw her while she was underwater in her mermaid costume.
Because that's going to leave a mark. I mean, you're going to remember that.
I hope so. I
let's just say it was.
Let's just say she was holding a starfish when he knew that was it.
Someday that starfish would be his heart.
That's interesting to me that like, so your dad grows up in Rochester.
Yeah.
Goes into the army.
Yep.
Goes to law school. Yep. Then all of a sudden he's in Europe following Pink Floyd around. Those are two like decisions made from two different people.
Who doesn't know that story?
Or you're like really smart because he like got his law degree. He got it. He went through law school and then he's like, now I'm going to be a hippie. Like he got in the right order actually.
Like I've earned this.
Well, like, yeah, like he's like, if it doesn't work out as a hippie, I can just go be a lawyer. As the other way, like you go too deep and you're like hippie guy for 5 years. It's harder to go to law school at that point, probably.
That's true. That's a very pragmatic way to look at it.
Yeah. He said he was like a pretend hippie, but, yeah, they moved to Oregon and
to be back. Was that because, I mean, your mom's family was there, like that was a familiar place kind of thing?
Yeah, they went back to San Francisco for a minute where my dad had lived during law school, and they worked in a diner together. And then I think my dad passed the bar. And my mom was like, I can't do this. I'm sixth generation Oregonian. I gotta get back to my hometown. And so I think my mom was a big driving force for them heading back to Oregon. And they went up there, I think, I don't know if it was like a trip, and they ended up being like, okay, this is where we're going to go. And so, and my dad needed a place to kind of start a practice. And I think Eugene was the right size of town. And they bought this little house literally where you could like touch both walls with, you know, two hands. And my dad just said he figured out how to start his own practice, and he was a wreck every day. He was so nervous, he said. But
man. And but then yeah. when did they have y'all? When did the kids enter the equation?
So yeah, they had my brother, and then I was shortly after that. And so yeah, I kind of grew up in this home where there was a lot of rough edges, I would say, in my parents. You know, my dad had come from a really difficult family, and my mom's parents had just gotten divorced, but they both also had like, we're in this kind of real spiritual awakening moment in the Northwest, like around some of the like early Jesus movement stuff with like, where like Bob Dylan was becoming a Christian and like these other people. Mm-hmm. So they had this really cool, like kind of non-religious idea that there was this really gracious God, and they had both radically kind of gone through that thing. And so they were kind of conundrums where they were like rough people, but also really humbled and beautifully grace-filled and just like had this really, so I grew up in this kind of evolving understanding of healing, and people were going on. My mom ended up becoming a therapist and working with families and counseling. And my dad was just always a super tender hearted guy, just, you know, working on his own demons as he went through life. So I kind of grew up in the middle of that, of this really beautiful, I look back and I was like, wow, there was like, you know, crazy stuff that goes on like any family, but there was so much love and so much grace and so much like kind of commitment to the journey of getting better as people and understanding their own shortcomings. And also the kind of hippie Eugene thing where there's like artists in my family. My uncle was a painter. He also built houses. My grandma was a painter. There was a lot of creative people. So that was just like really celebrated. And partly growing up in that Eugene kind of hippie culture, is it's some of that stuff's really looked fondly at. So it wasn't considered something ridiculous, you know, like pursuing an art was like looked at as like a good thing, not as like a liability.
You know, it's so profound to hear you say, and I feel like I need to be told this every morning. And you just said that this even in passing, because I think it's something that you grew up with. But I think it's so profound how powerful it would be for us as parents if we do what you said, which is to remember that we are always living in evolution. You know what I mean? I think it's easy for me to feel like I am who I am, and I parent that way, I friend that way, I perform that way, I write that way. But I love that's such a beautiful way to say that. That really like that pinged me really hard. Like this idea that like your parents were more obviously doing that because they had gone through this real spiritual reformation. But even for people like us who may have done that long ago, and you kind of feel like, oh, I kind of know who I am and I'm doing my thing. And yeah. I think especially per this podcast, how we think about our kids, what a great thing for me to hear and to be challenged by is that I'm still in massive evolution. Yeah. Like every day, like I'm not Dave, the dad who's, this is my dad was like this. It's like, no, he was learning. Yeah. He was always changing. He was getting better. That's a really profound thought to me. I love how you said that about your parents, because I think that may have been more obvious to you, but I think we're all still doing that, hopefully. You know what I mean?
Well, and I think that the trajectory of their lives was they kind of, you know, they didn't grow up in this culture where you kind of like pretend like, okay, we're all good people. We do the right thing. Like they had been in really rough things and they had that had changed. So this kind of journey was like to be committed to changing and growing was just like part of like, it was accepted as normal. It wasn't like you had to have it all figured out. Mm-hmm. I mean, even my dad, he's 75. I remember 2 years ago, he was like in counseling, trying to work through some of his issues with his parents. And he was like, he sat down one day with this letter he had written and was like crying, reading this letter about seasons of his life where he was walking in fear. And he really like finally is understanding how that's really defined his life in a lot of ways he didn't like.
At 75.
Yeah, he's like 75 crying to me and he's like working on himself. And I was just like, I remember being so inspired, like, dude, that's just kind of what was modeled to me was like, you don't have it figured out. You're, you know, you're a mess in a lot of ways. I think that like that pressure not to be awesome and have it figured out. And some of that is that kind of approachable, vulnerable thing that does maybe coming from Oregon and that part of the country, you don't have as much of that kind of social, like keeping up with the Joneses. I mean, everyone feels that pressure, but I think some of the like social country clubby, I don't know, social ladder, some of the stuff wasn't as prevalent in the communities we grew up in, maybe. I don't know.
Well, it's like spiritual growth without the structure of sort of the country club or the church, or like, this is what we are. So we have a shorthand for all this stuff.
Yeah. And I mean, and we definitely grew up in like this really cool, like kind of hippie church thing that was, it wasn't that hippie. That sounds wrong. But it was pretty normal, and it was a vibrant part of our lives too. Cause it was kind of these ex hippies that were like forming a church together basically. So that was a huge.
So did your dad grow up in the church? Like when you say he heard this this audible voice, who did he think that was?
He grew up Catholic, but he would say just that was more of like a cultural thing that he grew up in. He just knew nuns were mean and they like beat the crap out of him in school. But no, he didn't. Yeah. He didn't really have any sort of. Neither did my mom, honestly. Like they didn't really come from any worldview like that.
John,
Dave,
we're both right. Spring is springing as we speak, and my wife Annie is persistent about spring cleaning. Mm-hmm. The biggest challenge is she always makes me go in the closet and chuck a bunch of stuff I'm not using. And then there's that sad moment when I get the jeans up and they're a little more snug than they were last year, and I start crying in front of her, and she wants to leave the closet immediately.
I know. Yeah, she sends pictures. But you know, we typically try to tidy up our place around spring as well, like everybody else.
Yep.
But I don't mind. It
no,
because I get to power wash things. Have you ever power washed lately?
Yes,
that is one chore that is no chore at all.
No, that's a good
and speaking of tidying up, now is the perfect time to get your life in order as
I see
well.
What you did there, I like that. One of the ways that I'm doing that is by protecting my family with life insurance with my friends at Policy Genius, who are awesome with helping with that.
Policy Genius is where you can compare top insurers in one place and 50% or more on life insurance policies.
I love that. First, you head to policygenius.com. www.mattsmith.com. In minutes, you can work out how much coverage you need in Pair Quotes. You can find policies for as little as $15 a month.
That's crazy.
And you might even be eligible to skip the in-person medical exam.
I don't like in-person medical exams.
Me too.
My least favorite kind of in-person medical exam. And that's not even the best part.
Yeah.
All of the benefits of Policy Genius, the comparison tool, the handling of paperwork, the unbiased advice, they're all totally free.
No.
Free, I said. That's what I said.
Well, I'm not pushing back. While you're tidying up your house for spring, why not get your life insurance organized too?
You could save 50% or more by comparing quotes and feel good knowing your loved ones are taken care of. Go to policygenius.com to get started.
Policy Genius. When it comes to insurance, it's nice to get it right.
Something that I think is so fascinating, listening to you talk about your dad, which I always wonder about how these things, even on an osmotic level, we as kids pick these things up. But you talked about music with him following Pink Floyd across, and obviously with you being a musician now. But something I think is really fascinating that, me being a huge soccer fan, that I was telling John before we were kind of getting together this morning to make sure we knew what we were doing. But one of the things I said that I think is so interesting about you is that you went on he went on a golf scholarship, but you went on a soccer scholarship. So there are these weird things that, that I'm always like, I wonder if that was something that you thought, well, music is cool because dad followed a band across when he was an adult, and sports are cool because dad went and did his golf scholarship. You know what I mean? Like how these things sort of can, without us knowing it sometimes, or it becomes doable because it's already happened in their life. You know what I mean? So tell me about the soccer scholarship. Like what?
That is a Wikipedia fact that's been blown out of proportion. I did play soccer in college at Chico State University.
Yep.
Scholarship is a very loose term for, like, I think I got help with like some of my books and stuff.
Hey, but
like,
it counts. But it's a lowercase s, but it's still an s.
I mean, it definitely, I don't even know if, yeah, I definitely played soccer in college. I was, what's funny is people in Eugene don't know me as a musician at all. Or during that season of life, high school, I was a soccer player. I was an athlete. I was an art. I was like the weird artist that like hung out in, the fine art part of our high school. I was way into art, like photography and painting and that kind of thing. Hmm. So that was the only thing that was maybe not the normal jock, but I was a soccer player and went to college and, thought I would, that was my passion. It's what I'd always done. Played soccer, played for a really awesome club team in Oregon that we went on to all these tournaments. But I got to college and like didn't know what else to do. So I became an English major and started writing. And I found that as a soccer thing, you get to college and it's like, all of a sudden it's a part-time job and your coach is kind of not very nice. And I don't know. I learned pretty quickly that I think I peaked my first week of my freshman year. Honestly, that was literally like the best I ever did, was like early on. And then music slowly started. I started really not doing music till college and writing around that season of my life.
How did, like, what was the entry into music like? Like, what made you think, I'm going to start playing guitar, I'm going to start playing piano, I should sing this song that I'm writing? Like, how did that happen?
Well, music was such a deep part of, I would say, and this came from my upbringing, was music was just, like, really celebrated. And I wouldn't say my parents were, like, super music heads or something, but often my dad would, like, be blaring music on Sunday mornings. Like Paul Simon's Graceland is like the most vivid memory I have as a kid musically. But I also remember Michael Jackson's like Thriller and James Taylor. And it was just really celebrated. My dad could kind of be goofy sometimes. So he'd like play music in the morning and we'd be making pancakes and like Michael Jackson would be bumping. And I remember just really celebrating music. And then I deeply fell in love with it to where I'd be up in my room listening to like Bobby Brown and like crying about Tenderoni, like I had a Tenderoni, and I'd be like, I'd literally be in tears. So there was some sort of pipeline that music really deeply, deeply affected me. So it was just, I was such a fan of music, and it was such a huge part of my heart that I just kind of like picked up a guitar in college. Basically, my roommate had a guitar and learned a few chords. And honestly, it was, so hard for me to cover other people's music because I wasn't very good that it was easier for me just to start kind of writing songs. It was like just kind of two chords and say some stuff. And like, that's way easier than like whatever John Mayer's doing. I was like, I don't know how to do all that. So it was probably Dave Matthews actually at that time. John Mayer wasn't even a thing yet. But so I just kind of, it was like build the ship as you make it or as you go kind of deal with music. I just was such a fan of it. And I don't really have a good story of how I got into it other than it just
kind of happened.
Stole my roommate's guitar and literally would go sit for hours playing two chords and writing songs. And that was like probably my sophomore year in college.
And you, yeah. I mean, the other thing that's so interesting about you growing up in Portland is, I mean, you were kind of there maybe on the back end of it, but still in that just Northwestern music explode. I mean, that was explosion. That was like Nirvana, Pearl Jam. I mean, granted, that's more Seattle, but still like there were a couple bands that were Portland bands that were huge. Meat Puppets, I think, is still Seattle, but there was some of those.
Like Modest Mouse was one, you know, and then like Decemberists and.
Yeah, that stuff was like happening back then.
Yes. Honestly, though, I wasn't listening to that. I was listening to like Tribe Called Quest and like De La Soul and the Northwest scene. I kind of knew some. There was a band called The Daddies. They were like the swing band that was a big deal to me. Do you remember them?
No.
Cherry Pop and Daddy.
Yeah. I remember them.
Zoot Suit Riot.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
No. Like it was like swing music for some reason. We go to all their concerts, which is funny. But music was really celebrated, obviously, around, and especially like all my friends' parents were like ex-hippies. So like the Beatles and that Bob Dylan and that thing was always being played. Bob Marley was such a big influence in my high school. Everyone listened to it all the time. There were like cults that literally they followed him. There was a Uprising mural. The cover of his Uprising album was on one of our high school walls. Mostly I was listening to hip hop back then. I wasn't listening to that stuff.
Which is funny because again, yeah, that's one of the things I told John we were talking about today. Like I remember meeting you and being so blown away. Like I talked about with Trainwreck where I was like, here's this guy that's doing this rap spoken word thing with a guitar, which for me was like alien sorcery. I was like, what is this amazingness? So it makes sense that that's what you would have been listening to, because obviously that's so much of how you started was that sort of dual thing you were doing where you were singing, but you could also do these sort of spoken word raps that was so unique and you were so good at, you know, like you had a real skill set for it. So it makes a lot of sense that you aren't like cranking Pearl Jam 10, you were listening to, I Left My Wallet in El Segundo, as opposed to, you know, like Smells Like Teen Spirit or whatever.
I definitely had that Pearl Jam record and loved it. But yeah, I was leaning more towards that world, weirdly, like East Coast stuff.
Yeah, that's so fascinating. And so you go to college, we know you make the trek here, and then you meet Annie, though, after you've been here a while, right? Your life kind of, music starts going, you know. But that's kind of like a little later into the you being here, right?
Yeah, I'd been here 10 years maybe.
Oh, really? That long?
8 years when I met my wife. Yeah. Okay. I was here for a while trying to, I was working at Starbucks. I was just trying to, I got here early. It was a road trip. A friend of mine in college, when we started writing music, he wanted to start recording my songs. And so we recorded a few when I would go home for Thanksgiving. And he said, hey, man, I'm going to move to Nashville. I had some inroads to like be a producer. Will you help me drive across the country? If you do, then we can record some of your songs. And so we packed up the truck. We drove across the country, slept in the back of it, got to Nashville, slept in a parking lot in Cool Springs for a while. And like, it was like this fun college summer thing we were going to do. And I was going to be here for a month, maybe get a job for the summer. And we started recording songs and some people, like little small figures in the music industry back then, but still to me, heard some of those first recordings and were like, dude, this is good. You should think about it. And it was enough for me to call home and be like, guys, I'm dropping out of school. I'm going to move to Nashville and be a musician. And I'm kind of, yeah.
How did they react?
Weirdly, like, I remember my dad was like, okay, can you get into school somewhere?
Because what year of school would this have been?
This would have been my junior year. So this was going into my senior year.
Oh my gosh.
And my dad was like, well, can you go to school? And but weirdly, it was like, okay, if you need to do this. There were enough, like, I remember, like, Toby Mac heard some of my demos, and he really liked it. Some other people. So there was enough of, like, they're like, wait, I think I heard of that guy. You know, like, he likes your music, you know, that kind of thing. That it was enough that, like, okay, this isn't totally insane, but this is pretty insane.
Well, you know what's funny, at the risk of interrupting, one of the things that's so cool about sitting in that car, and I know, Ed, it really thumped Ed, was you played Nothing Left to Lose. And it was so obvious. It was like, oh, that's like a hit. Like, so it's one thing if you meet a kid, me, you, whoever those guys were at the time, and they're playing these songs, you're like, yeah, this is cool. But then it's another thing when you've got a song that people are like, yo, come by Monday and let's sit down. Because I remember Ed, I think you and Ed even got together after that and hung and you played some more tunes for him. Because I remember him being like, I remember driving home and he was like, dude, that song, that's a song. Like he's got, so I mean, you know, I think to encourage and bolster the story even more, I think it's not just you're great, but I think especially once you had written that song, I think you had that golden ticket in some ways, you know, that's not just a cool meeting when they're like, well, keep us up to date with what you're doing. They're going, hey, can you send that song? you know, it's like, it becomes that whole thing, you know?
But I'm curious what your parents, I'm curious about two things. One, did you feel like you needed to sell this to your parents, sort of? And two, what was their kind, or were they always just like, you do whatever you want? You can go to law school or you can follow Pink Floyd around Europe. You do whatever you want. I mean, I'm guessing that's the outlook that you kind of grew up under.
Definitely that was celebrated more than normal. I remember in our high school, they put up this wall, this picture on the school hall, and it was like of the map of the US, and they put pins in where all the kids were going, and it was like celebrated to leave your town.
Yeah.
There was no like go to state, you know, like that was just not part of Eugene, Oregon, weirdly. So yeah, my parents were the same way. You know, it was like my brother went in backpack through Europe, you know, between his senior year and his freshman year of college, like that was celebrated. So there was this kind of like, man, this is your life. You got to figure it out. Do your thing. I remember my dad being like, if you need to do this, that's cool. You're on your own. Like go figure it out financially. But if you need to do this, you got to do it. And so weirdly, I didn't feel like I had to sell it to them. I think I had just enough going, like with some people and some names they'd heard of, that it helped my cause. But I was going. Like, I mean, I got in the truck and drove to Nashville without, it was like, this is what I'm doing for the summer. And which is pretty privileged in some ways that like I could just do that. And like we had the means, as me and Robert, to drive across the country. And like, I don't know. There is such a like a culture that my parents creatively set up that was like, whatever you need to do creatively was celebrated. I remember I took like airbrush lessons at one point in my life, like from this dude that, like, looking back, I was a sophomore in college. No, I didn't drive, so I must have been a freshman. No, I was a sophomore. He, like, the first meeting, he's like, meet me at this art store. My mom dropped me off. We went in. I watched him steal like airbrush paint, put him in his pocket. We drove back to his house. His girlfriend 100% was a stripper, he told me, which, like, there's that. And which I don't think I passed on to my parents, that information.
Sure.
And it wasn't like
she, you wait on that. She, you wait on that detail.
I mean, she's not like dancing around. I'm just saying, he just mentioned it to me. And then we're like working out of his apartment. We like worked on this piece together, and he was teaching me how. And my mom, I think he drove me home or something. I was just like, some of that's just ridiculous and bad parenting, actually, if you break it down.
But they have created this sort of vibe. And you, when you get in that truck and you're driving to Nashville, you're like, no, this is the culmination of what you have taught me. I'm catching in on what you gave me.
One day I went, so my senior year, I was going to visit one of my best friends in the world, Marshall Roman, who was in New York for spring break. So they dropped me off at Eugene Airport, and I had spring break because he was a freshman in college. He was my best friend. He was a year older than me. He was going to school, and I was going to meet my brother in Boston, and I was going to take a train to New York. My brother was going to school in Boston. I show up to, that's pretty adventurous to let, 18-year-old, but not crazy, go on a flight to New York, whatever. It's kind of big deal, but my brother's there, best friend's there. Okay. Drop me off at the airport. They leave, have a great flight. Flight gets canceled. And I call them and I'm sitting there and they're like, hey man, the next time we're gonna be able to get you out is like 4 days from now. Well, I'm like, this is my spring break. I can't miss 4 days of it. That's like half the trip. And there were these two German guys there and I heard them talking and they're like, I think we're gonna rent a car and go to drive up to Seattle. And I remember, like, I was like, hey, if I chip in, can I ride with you guys up to Seattle? Because there was a flight that was leaving Seattle that could get me there on time. Just remember hearing them talk about it. And I remember calling my mom and be like, hey, mom, so my flight's canceled. But I met these two guys that are driving up to Seattle. It's a 5-hour drive. Do you mind if I, like, what do you think about me hitchhiking in the back seat with them and, like, them drop me off at the airport? And I remember her being like, okay, let me think about this. She's like, in my spirit, I feel like, yeah, this could be a good thing. I feel a peace about it. Why don't you just go ahead and like hitchhike up to Seattle? And I did. I hitchhiked up to Seattle. I was in the back seat. They dropped me off literally on the side of the road. I had to take a cab to like the airport, slept on the floor, got up and made it to my buddy's house just in time. And so, yeah, that was a culture that
that's amazing. Yeah. Which,
looking back, I would probably not let my daughter do that, but...
No, we're ticking a lot of boxes on things that I will never let my daughters do.
Right? But it did create this kind of like this like, hey, you're a human, you're an adult, like you can fail, you can sink or swim.
Yeah.
And when I did that, I remember telling my mom, I was like, hey, I asked these guys if I could hitchhike with them and they got kind of nervous. So I think it's okay if they're freaked out. If they're more freaked out than me, then
right.
Probably yeah. In good hands, you know.
I can just hear them now, like cut to 2021. And he's like, Gunther, do you remember when that boy got in the car? That was Matt Carney with the songs. Yes. Do you remember? Like, that's they're at every dinner party. Like, wait, here's a fun fact. Two truths and a lie, but one of the two.
The best part is we got pulled over out of Seattle because they were used to like driving on the Autobahn. So they're flying to get there. And I pulled over and I'm in the back seat, they're in the front seat. And I go, just speak German. Just speak German. Just anything he says, just speak German. And so the cop pulls over and he's like, hi, do you know how fast you're going? And he was like, Guten Tag, like he did the whole thing. And he's like, you're going too fast. And he was like, no English. He just like spoke German to him back and forth. And the guy's like, hey, can you slow down? I'm like, and he's like, oh, okay, slow down. And then he let him go. I was like, and they were like high-fiving me. They're like, yeah, the American knows what's up.
That is something that I do tell my daughters to do. Yeah. If you ever get pulled over, just speak German.
I'm going to do that for sure. Guten Tag, guten Morgen, Hamburger, Switzerland. That is great. So you're in Nashville. You meet Annie. You're bonkers about her. Was that sort of courtship an easy one? Was it labored? Was she in? Was she out? Did it take a while? Like, what was that sort of dating life like?
I remember she didn't really care when we met. She doesn't remember when we met. She says she does, but I don't think she does. She was shopping at Anthropology. I was like, who's this? Wow, she's attractive. And I knew she was with a group of friends I knew. And I was like, hey, I'm Matt. We've met before, right? She goes, no, we haven't.
That was just a pickup line though. I mean,
I actually kind of like recognized her from, I thought I recognized her. I was like, hey, have we met before? She goes, no. Like
from your dreams.
Yeah. And, it was, I knew pretty early on that I really thought something was special. I probably knew in the first like month that I would marry her. And then that freaked me out. And it took me like a year to get back to that place. Cause I was like, whoa.
And your parents are like, you've been together for over 4 weeks.
Yes.
Just get
married. Why aren't you married?
Totally. Let's talk about if that's your story, what that anxiety that creates in your child. Like, do I have to know?
Right.
Like you're like, well, you meet some girl. You're like, no, I feel nothing.
We should know.
You're like, Dad, listen, I met this girl. I know. Let me just say this. Here's the thing. She's not a mermaid. And so it's really throwing me off.
He's like, mermaid or non-mermaid? Yeah. That's another non-mermaid.
I don't know. I'm really going my own here and not marrying women. We met and it was awesome. And like, you know, we came from two different worlds to talk about. She's from Nashville and born and raised in a small town, Kosciuszko, which Dave,
yeah.
You know, like, yeah, you guys knew each other.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's
that
crazy.
Was a weird, that was the weird thing is that they were, you know, they went to the church that my dad passed. Like they were really close friends of ours, the Sims. And so it was such a trip when she was here. And then it was really small world when her and Matt started dating. So I was like, wow, this is like all of my world is becoming this little thing. Mm-hmm.
Kosciuszko, bro. So she was from Kosciuszko, which is, you know, you can say is it, you, it's a small town from Mississippi. And like there couldn't be a farther culture, you know, Kosciuszko, Mississippi and Eugene, Oregon. They're just worlds apart. And like some of that's been awesome. Some of that was like the initial just attraction was just like, who are you? You are this total mystery to me. And I think she felt some of the similar things towards me, just complete opposites attracting. And totally different personalities and, but beautifully complement each other. I, you know, I still think that, I hope that's true. It seems to be true most days. And, but that's our story. We were definitely the opposites attract, you know, there's a lot of tension there at times, which is, I love, there's a lot of fireworks in our, in kind of our courtship, dating, and even still, we're just a lot of firepower. She's feisty. I'm opinionated and, but it the net result is like a really beautiful kind of tension. It's a great salad dressing with the lemon juice and the fats and the umami. There's a lot of counterpoints happening in our relationship.
So when you guys are in these little fiery kind of, you know, firecracker moments, this is something I notice myself doing. So I'm curious what your experience is. I notice myself, whether it's just innately that I'm doing it or that it's what I observed my dad doing all growing up, but I take the stance that he always took. Whenever I heard he and my mom kind of getting like these little arguments and he kind of takes this little route and I know it drives my mom crazy and then I hear myself, I can't even help myself but take this sort of devil's advocate sort of route. I morph into Mike McLaughlin. Do you do any of that? Do you notice that that's happening?
Oh yes. I mean, I am. Yeah. I mean, you're the tools of with which you were formed, right? Are like so, so present. They're so, I don't know if they ever not, you know, And my dad, you know, he would be pretty vocal about this and open, but he came from a pretty abusive relationship. So he really broke the cycle of that in our family.
Yeah.
But he was really intense at times. And but
did that come out in like intense, like, meaning like you need to like behave or like you need to get good grades
just,
or you need
just
to-
like bolsterous kind of like loud, you know. Very, very dynamic arguments, you know, like our family was very much that thing. And in it's
passion.
Funny because me and Annie both came from that. Whereas my mom, you realize how much of the role of like kind of like the level-headed, like peacemaker, she doesn't really have triggers. Like, but what's funny is me and Annie both come from similar relationships like that. So there is no non-triggered kind of human in our relationship. So that's been something we've had to figure out as like when one person gets triggered, the other person tends to also. And like, that is something we're really working on is like, how do we, when one person isn't triggered.
Dave is
like,
crying
hey,
right now.
Yes. Like, how do we like, hey, like you're kind of losing it a little bit. Like I'm going to be the peacemaker right now and talk you out of your thing. No, it's like, oh, you're losing it. I'm losing it. Well, if you're losing it, I'm losing it. And then we're just, it's like, we are passionate and it's honestly, it's been a really cool, kids are a radical thing for that for us. Like where we used to like allow certain places, certain things to happen, you know, it doesn't take long before you look over and there's a little kid looking at you with wide eyes and you're like, oh, okay. Like,
you know, it's so funny you say that, Matt. Annie and I are very similar. Like we have you know, one of the things that's so funny about being so close to John and Amy is that John and Amy are like the most calm and you hang out with him and you just feel your heart rate just slowly goes down. Like they're, you know, I've never seen John mad. Amy
just
only
goes down and down until we're all asleep.
I will take that. I will take that. But you know, Amy only like laughs when she talks. I mean, they're just like the most easy. I've never seen them get mad at each other. And then there's Annie and I, which are very different. We are dynamic. We both are super opinionated. We're first children. We're both A-type. We're both driven. It's like all the, it's like we can, like John and Amy will leave and we're like, we're just the bad versions of them. Like they're like the redeemed heaven-like versions. We're the thing before you pass through the gate, you know, and then you come out the other side. But something you said that I think is so true. When we, you know, so Annie and I, when we can fight, we can scrap, you know, like we really stay in our corners and we're scrapping. Kids were such an interesting addition to that, because I'll never forget the first time that Ben, who's now 9, but he would have been like, you know, 4 at the time, was like, "Daddy," and this is in like one of those kind of heated moments. He's like, "Why is your face like this? Why is your?" And he was doing his eyebrows scrunch and kind of a mean face. And I was like, "Oh boy, this is not bad."
Yeah,
you know. And so now Finny and I mean, thankfully, I think a lot of what was hard for us was just the young kids season. Like that is not our marriage, by the grace of God, is we've learned how to do that a lot better. It's not as combustible. But I think the entry of kids was this crazy mirror of like, oh my gosh, like our kids are watching and really taking in. And I mean, Zanna, you know, our little girl, when she was around the same age, was like, "Daddy, why are you mad at mama?" And I was like, "Oh God," you know what I mean? It becomes this little reality check, you know, these little humans that walk around that they can feel that energy. And
well, because for a little while you can kind of get away with it. They're yeah. young, but now our girls, Luca and Livy, they especially Luca, she's at that phase that I actually remember when I was a kid. I remember experiencing this, where if Amy and I, just hypothetically, because like Dave said, we don't actually fight, but just hypothetically, I'm imagining what that would be like. Luca would then, she's instantly like tuned in to what's going on. She can hear the tone of our voices. Yeah. And she's like, "Are you guys fighting?" And, you know, and we're like, we're just talking. Sweetie, we're just talking. Go watch TV. You know,
I'm pretty sure there was a moment with one of ours where they said, "Can y'all just hug?" And we hugged, and you would have thought it was like literally, you know, the North
like
and the South mid Civil War. The two generals were like made to hug for a press shot, and we're just kind of like hugging, you know, like, "Oh, God." Oh, dear.
Yes.
And do you find, I mean, so y'all have two little girls?
Yeah.
It's something that I think, I mean, John has two girls too. We have our one girl, Zanna, but girls are such an interesting addition to that, because I do, you know, I think they pick up on those things very differently. There's much more of like a, to John's point with Luca, how she's like, "Oh, the tone shift." You know, what have you found with your two girls? Like what has been, what are those things you've been like, "Wow, girls, this is interesting. That's a new thing that I'm learning."
Well, I mean, I grew up with brothers, three boys, and no sisters. Women were a mystery to me in all ways. And so just like practically, there's a lot of things you have to learn. Like, you know, I just didn't know, like which directions you have to wipe and think. I'm sorry. There's just like a lot I didn't know.
I know.
With like babies, I'm just like learning. Sorry. That's not important.
But it's true.
It's true. There are some practical things like that.
It is interesting having this like, it's, I love it so much. I was scared on some level because I didn't know how to enter that world. But, but it has been unbelievably rich to have like, I just didn't know. I didn't know what it'd be like to have daughters. And I literally couldn't imagine it any other way. And it's like, Olive is so freaking smart and intuitive. And yeah, there is that. There is that kind of like woman's intuition, like emotionally more probably complex individuals than like the little boy banging something. I don't know.
Right.
So there is that dynamic of Olive is like so smart, our oldest, that yeah, like in moments she's picking up on things and it is a thing, man. I'm learning every day. I'm still figuring out. She's four, so we're just like every year. I feel like what you said, how you slowly get to, it's almost like a gift. Like you have this little child that can remember nothing. You could, they don't even know words you're using. So you can like say stuff. You and your wife are fighting. You could say whatever you wanted, really. But they're kind of like, and then slowly you're like, oh, well, maybe I need to like, you know, like you slowly have accountability every age until yeah. you're, it's like allowing you to grow slowly and like kind of like deal with your stuff as you get older.
Yeah.
And now all of his, yeah, she just knows what's going on. And she'll kind of like make this noise. Like if she sense, she gets it confused though. Sometimes she thinks I kind of get passionate and talk. So if I'm happy and when she, or when I'm arguing, she may misinterpret those sometimes still, but she'll make this noise. Like she'll like go like, ah, like if she wants you to like stop. So me and her mom are fighting. All of a sudden from the other room, I hear like this, ah, ah, like, and I'm like, what damage am I doing to my child emotionally that she's learning this like caw noise to like break our attention span? Like, somehow.
Like what is Olive's like 28-year-old version of that going to
yeah,
be?
Yeah, like is she
is
be,
it
like,
the same be, sound? Yeah. You know,
yeah. She's in a fight with her husband. And she's like ah! He's like, oh, God, okay, I'll stop.
Yeah, I feel like our oldest can't quite tell time yet, but we have lost so many of those things like you're referring to, like, oh, we can still, she's a baby, all but, you know, we can do whatever. Now it's like, oh, now she knows what we're saying. Now she can understand. And now it's like, I feel like our last thing is time. Because I can lie to her, which I every day almost, I'm like, it's been 5 minutes. And she's, you know, she's not at the point now where she can look at the clock and be like, no, it hasn't been, or whatever.
Oh, dude.
That's like, a, it's time to go to bed. It's only 6:30.
Yeah.
You know?
She just does. That's awesome.
That I'll never forget. Ben was like that. And then like it got to where the bedtime was where it got the worst. She'd be like, it's time to go to bed. And they'd be like, okay, but Dad says it's time to go to bed. And then Ben yes. started to be like, it's 6:47. I'm like, and that's now bedtime. So
I am dreading that day when that happens. I'm texting our teachers being like, can you skip that unit until like fourth, fifth grade? It's like, we got a good thing going.
Yes. So you kind of just spoke to this, but when you think about your girls, what have been the things that surprised you? Like, and not even pertaining to girls, but just with kids, like has been anything for you and Annie that you've been like, wow, this is new. This was unforeseen.
I think, you know, the first thing that comes to mind, which I don't know if this is an answer, but I remember me and Oliver sitting on the backyard and you're like, I love your mom. I want to have a kid. I want to express our love for each other. And it's kind of what you do as people. And I don't know, just like, that sounds like a fun journey to go down and like grow our thing. And I remember I was sitting on the front porch or the back porch with Olive and we're listening to this song and she's laughing with me and we're like joking. And I'm like, all of a sudden my eyes are like filling up with tears. And I'm like, oh, you're going to be like my friend too one day. Mm-hmm. And like, oh, like, oh, you're like, this is like, I'm bringing friends into the world. Like, we're probably going to go to a concert together someday. And like, oh, our like tribe of like your community is getting bigger. And that was shocking to me because I don't, you know, I was modeled that actually. I look at my dad, he's one of my friends today. My mom is one of my best friends. Like, I love them so much. They're a part of, I like enjoy hanging out with them, going, getting dinner with them, which is not maybe normal. I don't know. Maybe that's normal. But that is the shocking thing to me is like it's selfishly also kids are the worst thing to do on some level. Like they're a pain in the butt. Like I never got up before 9 o'clock ever as a musician until they came into my life. And now I literally can't stay up past 9:30 because I'd like, feel like I get headaches because I'm having a panic attack like they are the worst thing for your life. Actually, they're hard on your marriage. They're all these things. But then weirdly, there's like the selfish thing where you're growing your tribe and you're like, there are these people that are going to be in your life for the rest of your life. If you do it decently, if you care about it, you respect them and you treat them right. And you cultivate your relationship with them. They're either going to be like your best friends and you have these like friends you're gaining, which is like, was mind-blowing to me. I never thought about that. But as we're laughing, listening to the song, I'm struck with that revelation.
You know, it's something that I feel this way. First of all, that's beautiful. I wrote that
yeah,
down.
Yeah, I literally teared up when you said
cool. that. I was like, we are free friends of the world. And then immediately heard Michael W. Smith singing in the background. But you know,
that was the song they were listening to.
That is, but, yeah.
Just on loop.
I think the thing that I also realized, and I don't know if you feel this way with your girls, like with Ben, my oldest, you have a big Arsenal football club fan, Go Gunners. And now both my boys, they're just indoctrinated. They have posters, T-shirts, every holiday or every Christmas and or birthday, they just want new kits. It's like, and I did this to them. So it's not just you're bringing friends in the world. You're bringing these friends that you get to sort of like super make, where you're like,
you're oh, programming them.
And I feel the weight of that so much. And in the soccer thing is a microcosm, but I think it's really profound in that. I'm like, I'm sort of choosing this joy and pain for these little people because, and sports is just such a small, but it is, it's like, I could have told them to follow like these clubs that just never lose. And they're always amazing and they'd have had a better life maybe, but I don't like those clubs. Now they're following this club that is kind of up and down, you know, and, but it really is a microcosm of a bigger thing, which is you really are bringing these kids into the world that almost are a cheat code to friendship. It to your point though, as long as you're kind of doing a good, decent job and they don't want to just rebel against it all. And then you've literally just created like arch enemy, but it's like, you know, there's all this weight that I feel that I sort of realized too late that I'm like, oh my gosh, all this stuff I like, they're just going to like for a while. And they may change that later, but for a while, it's going to be like, I mean, me and my three dudes, like me and it's the three Barnes dudes sitting on the couch watching the game every time there's one on. It's the best thing ever, you know?
Do you think about that with like your career at all? Like, would if your kids wanted to do music or something, have you walked that out?
So the other day, Luca wrote a song on the piano. And part of the reason why we bought a piano, which was pretty recently, I just bought it like 2 years ago, was I wanted...
You hadn't been playing for long. That makes sense.
Right. I felt like it was finally time to buy a piano.
30 years.
But I wanted them to grow up.
Rooms at Belmont, you know, just going in there.
Exactly. Just send them down the street.
Dude, you laugh. John talks about this all the time, but tell me you couldn't write a killer song in a practice room right now. I feel places are just...
That's where I wrote all of those piano songs off my first record was at Belmont practice rooms.
I'm telling you, dude.
I didn't own a piano. But go on. Your son wrote it. He got a piano. I want to know.
Luca, our daughter.
Oh, sorry.
So we got a piano.
I knew that.
We got a piano and so that they could just have one in the house. I just wanted it to be, you know... And honestly, half the time, it's annoying, as you would imagine. I mean, it's just like, there's nowhere you can go in the house to get away from the piano. But she wrote a song on, and I know I'm, you know, everyone can roll their eyes right now, but like, it's a good song. She's 8 years old. She wrote this little song and it's like, it has a hook to it. And there's, of course, there's a part of me that's like, I think I could kind of take that hook. A little bit. I'll give her a little bit of the publishing, you know. But she wrote this song. It has words to it. She like Amy made a video of her playing it. And it was a moment. It was like that moment like you're talking about where I hadn't even, of course I would love for them to be musicians or whatever. But I don't really care. They can do whatever they want. Yeah. But then there was this moment where she actually did this thing and created this thing. And I'm like, my heart just explodes. Cause I'm like, oh, this could happen. We could have music together, you know? And I'm curious, what was that thing for you and your dad? What's the, like you and your dad sitting on the couch watching Arsenal? What's that version for you growing up?
For us, it was soccer. He would be at every like, he was awesome, man. He worked a lot, but he had a teal cabriolet, which is hilarious. A Volkswagen cabriolet. He got it from some client. He always had these like hookups from clients. We'd have like these weird things that weren't quite. Well, it was a teal cabriolet. Like it's like.
Sure, right. It's not the black one.
He got it for a killer deal.
Did he represent the stripper by chance?
That was the cherry red one. But and he would come to every soccer practice, and he would, on his way home, he'd sit there, and even at soccer practice, he'd be waiting to pick me up. And that was our thing, I think. We really connected over was my soccer, and he was so supportive. He was always there. And yeah.
Yeah, that's cool.
You know, I was going to say this a minute ago, and just to backtrack for a second, one of the things that I think is really cool about, and it kind of speaks a little bit, it sounds like your upbringing with your parents, Matt, it's like, I do, one of the things that I love about growing up or having my kids grow up in Nashville, I wrote with Summer Overstreet yesterday, who's a writer here in town, and her dad is Paul Overstreet, who's had a bunch of hits. And I'm always fascinated by people who grew up in Nashville with a creative parent, like especially in the music industry, because I'm like, that's what my kids are. What was that experience like? What'd you like, not like? And so far, 100 out of 100 times, so 100%. I don't know if y'all can do that math as quick as I can, but kids are like, it was the best thing ever. And that's not because they went on to do music. Yeah. It's just because I think we talked about it yesterday because Summer kept laughing because I was just barraging her with these questions. But, you know, I found that there's something really unique about having a parent that does music, because I think, like we were saying, it's like the possibility for what you can do with your life turns into like this huge option wheel. It's no longer we do things that are everything but the arts. You know, and I don't think that parents say that because they don't want their kids to be, maybe some do. I think it's more just because it's just uncharted territory. It's like, yeah. I don't know how to coach you in that. I don't know what to expect for you, how to help you in it. But I think what's so great about parents that do what we do, and my hope with my kids would say the same, is that it just sort of, and it sounds like, again, your parents kind of already did this anyway, Matt, but it's just kind of like, no, you can do whatever. Man, come on. You want to do music? Rock the mic. I can help you out. But man, if you want to be an accountant, rock on. If you want a youth minister, whatever. But it's suddenly all the options get a little more open, as opposed to like with the traditional, I know this language, I can speak it to you, business world. And so I think for me, one of the things that I get so excited about having kids living in Nashville, the community that Nashville has, is that thing where it's like your daughter, you know, Luca comes in and goes, I wrote a song. And you're like, oh yeah, you probably did because you saw me writing them. You know what I mean? It's not, that's a spoken normal language. Whether she wants to keep doing that or not is up to her then. It's not, honey, I don't know what to tell you, or that we don't do that here. That's what, you know, like, that's what crazy hippies do or something, you know, it's like, it's kind of a known entity, you know?
When you kind of have like a avenue. Yeah, it is interesting. Cause I meet a lot of kids and you do maybe give them an opportunity greater than you had if they want to do that. Like, I can teach you how to write a song, or like there's skill set there that you'll be picking up. And I do think about that. I'm like, and then there's like the weird pressure of like, well, if you're James Taylor's son or something, is that like, are you burdening them? Like, if, you know, luckily I'm not James Taylor, so I don't have to worry about that. But I mean, there is that, I think about that often. And like, I remember when I had Olive, one of the weirdest things I was struck with when I found out I was having a girl, I was like, well, if she wants to pursue music, does that mean she has to like do it differently? Like, does she have to sexualize herself? Or like, you know, you watch the path women have to take a lot of times in the music industry, and it's not fair compared to what a dude does. And like, I remember I posted something about that on Instagram. Of course I got like ripped apart by people that like, left, you liberal or something. I'm like, no, I'm just saying, like, it's like some sort of feminist, you know, like the true sense of that word of like, do you believe women have the same opportunity as men? And like, I was thinking about music and what would her journey be like if it, you know, I never really thought about it that way clearly until it's like your daughter and you're like, whoa, if she wanted to go down this path, God, if she had to walk into that guy's office that I went into, creep me out, like, what would it look like for her? I don't know. I just, it's an interesting journey for me to go on. It's like, what if she wants to go down this path like me? What can I teach her? What'll be hard for her? I don't know. I just been thinking about that a lot lately. See you're doing the same thing, like picking up a guitar, wanting to write songs. She can't really play it, but she'll kind of pretend, and you know.
Mm-hmm. So, side note, because you brought this up, I'm curious just how, like, when you say that you posted something, like I posted something the other day that was a picture of my daughter. They're watching the inauguration. And to me personally, I felt like this was a picture that superseded politics. This is not a partisan thing. This is me having this moment with my daughters seeing the very first female vice president be sworn in. And if I, you know, I lose a couple hundred followers instantly, get some comments, all that kind of stuff. I'm just curious, what is your, when that kind of thing happens to you, how do you react?
I don't like it. I am by nature, do people like it actually? That's a dumb answer, but.
Well, no, I think there are people who
enjoy the
well, not enjoy, but they're okay with the repartee.
I would say that's one of my weaknesses as a human, honestly. Like, I think I am a Enneagram 3, if we're going to go there to that personality test. I love achieving. I love accomplishing. I love people thinking I'm cool. That's probably why I spent those 4 hours looking like didn't even try going to the coffee shop. That's actually not true.
That's true. You're always there 4 hours after they open.
I know.
It's funny.
No, John, the secret is you just buy clashing tones of the same color and you just look kind of cool, kind of interesting.
There it is.
Just by green. I just wear weird clashing versions of green and people are like, whoa, you look cool. That's
the next time you see me at the coffee shop, I'm going to be technically doing that and you're going to be like, oh, actually, that's the one way you can't do it.
So, John, one thing, camouflage doesn't apply. But I love your energy.
It can't be two different kinds of camouflage. No, I think that there are, you know, we all have artist friends, mutual friends who that is part of their online presence, which is great. I don't think that we should feel necessarily pressure to do that. And I think it's great when people do, but they make their opinions known.
Yeah.
And they get tons of backlash and they get in, you know, discussions and arguments as much of a discussion as you can have on social media. Man, but I feel like you, I just am not built for that. It affects me too much, I think.
Yeah.
I get this. I posted something the other day and I mean, I think everybody was like, how do you not post something about either the, you know, when they marched on the Capitol or, you know, between the inauguration, it was a lot of things that were low hanging fruit. And for my brain, it's going to be sense of humor. So I was like, I posted a picture of the dude with the crazy raccoon hat. And I said, weird place for Jamiroquai to drop a new single, but props. And I thought that was hysterical. And I ran it through everything in my brain. I was like, who could be offended by this tweet? And I was like, okay, one of my best buds sent it to him. He's like, I think that's hysterical posted. I was like, okay, I asked Annie. She actually said, don't post it, which I thought was funny. But I was like, I think it's okay. And oh my gosh, it was like everybody was, 90% were like, dude, I needed a laugh today. Thanks so much, which was the purpose. I was like, but man, that 10% that just went, you know, full throttle, like too soon, dude, insensitive. And I was like, well, what is it insensitive to though? Yeah. And I eventually pulled it because I was like, this is just not a hill I want to die on. But it's just so I don't enjoy it either. I mean, face to face, we can have a conversation. That's a total different thing. But when you're just sort of like at the mercy of, you know, people getting ripped to shreds by people who, I thought that was so funny too.
Well, and I wonder if like, I challenge myself. I'm like, are you scared? Do you care what people think too much? And I think that partly that's true of some of the stuff that I run from conflict in certain areas. I just don't want to be a part of it. Also, though, it's funny, like my career and what I've tried to do is like, you know, a lot of what I'm doing is trying to kind of build this like bridge between someone emotionally. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of what I do in my music is almost like I've learned from kind of my mom being a marriage therapist is like you're going somewhere vulnerable wise. You're trying to be vulnerable emotionally and lead in a way that like allows someone to kind of vicariously feel that journey and experience it and maybe touch their own emotions. And you're like, you're always trying to like build this thing between you and your audience where there's this intimacy and there's like a vulnerability, you know, I'm just like very vulnerable. And so to like put something out there and then have it be this like debate or fight is just very, I don't know. It's just very foreign to what I've been trying to do this whole time. But I have been challenging myself a lot on that because you're like, why is it so painful if someone doesn't like what you do or doesn't like something you post? Like that is an interesting journey I've been asking myself lately.
Yeah. Well, I think for
I don't have
for
answers.
Me, I see social media, and we, you know, last thought on this. I see there's so much limitation to social media.
Totally.
So I really try to, you know, that picture that I posted the other day, you know, again, I just felt like it was something that obviously it's a historic moment in our country, but as a dad of two daughters, I, you know, like I got them out of school. You know, they're doing virtual school. They stopped their classes. They came down. I wanted them to see this, you know? And so to me, I'm like, this is a big enough moment. I want to celebrate it, you know? But I do feel like, I just personally feel like there's not going to be a discussion here, you know? It's just not going to happen in the tech strand of an Instagram post, you know? So.
Yeah, that's we should do a whole other podcast on that. It'd be interesting to have like our friends like you, Matt, who sort of have social media presences and how you conduct yourself in a way, especially last time I'll say Annie and I read, she was reading to me out loud, the letters from a Birmingham jail, Martin, on MLK Day the other day. And I just was like, man, this is just so convicting as a white dude, because it's all, you know, to your point about privilege and all that stuff earlier, Matt, I know it's kind of a different thing, but. And then I think, gosh, how should that affect my social media presence? And what does that look like? And then, you know, I vacillate so hard between, well, it's a fantasy land. That's not real life. Like social media, there's no way to conduct a meaningful conversation. I'm never going to convert somebody to some line of thought because I post a quote by somebody. That's all interpersonal. But then I'm like, yeah, but it also is a chance to at least it's just that never ending.
Totally. And it's your feeling both of those things. And like,
yeah,
it's also your way of selling things. Like it's your avenue of like letting people know what you're doing is your job. So if like you're a plumber, you know, or everyone that's listening has a job, they make money probably on some level, or someone in their household makes money. And it's like, yeah, it's also that like, part of that thing. So you only have so much bandwidth you want to require of someone. You don't want to be like, listen to me talk about every subject in the world. And by the way, can you like give me 5 minutes for this? I don't know. Like, I just feel I've never been good at like demanding a ton of someone's attention. It's like, I use social media almost like, hey man, this is happening too. If you want to check it out, no pressure. You know, it's like,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, just if you care about me, I'm letting you know, this is what I did. And I've never felt very good at like, asserting it as my platform to the world. I don't know. That might be my age. That might be like my bent as a human, my weak spine as a,
well,
I can't even read his own reviews. I don't know. I just, it's a culmination of all that maybe that I'm
well, what, you know, John said this the other day, we had a long conversation about this and John said something I thought was really great. When you're thinking about, I'd rather that be the last thing that happens in a life of doing something. And then the last thing I think is like, oh, I should post that I went to that thing and did the thing, or I'm involved in this thing that I'm actively doing with my real life, than to post something, forget about it, and never do anything about it. You know what I mean? Because I feel like, well, that's a way that people can know I care about it. Well, no, the way people can know I care about it is I do it. I'm actively doing those things that instead of, and so I think it's, but then, you know, you get that dilemma. You're like, well, you know, I don't want people to not know that I care about it because I just do it in my real life. So it's just the never ending. Anyway. So, okay. So a few more things and we'll release you to getting back to playing soccer in the backyard. We've talked a lot about your dad, which is so fun. And it's fun because I don't know your dad. I've met him a few times. I don't know him well, but you know, my little brother and him play golf, and Brad always talks about how much he loves your parents. Like if they ever come up, he's like, dude, the Carneys are like the coolest family. Like you've got to, so I always feel jealous of that. But when we think about your dad, and then with you, it's kind of a double question. Like, what are ways you think you are similar to him? And then what are takeaways you have from watching him that you've found have sort of assimilated into how you think about your family? You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I am definitely split in the middle a lot. I have a lot of my dad and a lot of my mom. I would have thought historically I'm much more like my mom, but, some of like my humor and my business sense and, you know, some of that is really, my dad's actually a great writer too. So it comes from him. My mom was a pastor and a head of a counseling department and like the first female student body president of her high school. and did so many, like, she is the, like, we are bent a lot of ways in the trajectory of what we've wanted with our lives. And like, we've gone after things, but she, you know, they moved to town and my mom like sets up some listening party in their backyard. And then the whole neighborhood shows up and they're throwing like a songwriter's night. And then she got their local congressman elected single-handedly by like going door to door and just like campaign. She's just like a mover and shaker. And a lot of my, that kind of vision and the creative side came from her and in her kind of, she has big vision. And my dad was always the like steady, super hardworking, like Cal Ripken of life. Just like, get on base, like just keep doing it. Like single, like you're not, we're not, you don't have to swing for the fences. Just get on base, man. Like, and just keep doing it and do it for 20 years. And like, you look up and you'll be like, wow, I really built something cool. Yeah. And I definitely come from both of those worlds and been formed by both of them very much.
Huh. What kind of dad would you say you are? Like, what, you know, I know it's kind of a, that's an inside itself question, but you know.
Wow. That made me uncomfortable just even saying that, which maybe that's bad. What kind of dad am I? I think I'm a pretty affectionate dad. I feel like I really do, can the positive affirmation speaking kind of encouragement over my daughters is like, comes naturally to me. Mm. Hopefully I'm inspiring in some of my fun kind of like passion, some of what I do in life is, you know, through music and other things, like I see we share in a lot of those fun moments. That's a very interesting question. Can you guys answer that? Have you ever had to answer that question?
We don't answer our own questions. It is a tough question.
John, how would you answer that question?
I mean, it's tough to kind of like put it into...
Have you guys ever had to answer that question before on your podcast?
No, directly? We prayed that no one would ever flip it back on us.
Yeah, it's been a good run. So thank you guys for listening. It's been Dadville. And
Dadville, breaking news.
It's tough. I would say I'm definitely... I mean, my dad was very affectionate and I'm definitely very affectionate with my girls. And like to ad nauseum, like I am just like all over them all the time. And I'm goofy dad and you know, but I do feel like I'm more of a disciplinarian than I thought that I would be and that Amy thought that I would be. So that's sort of like I think that in these ways that I'm saying, I am like my dad was. You know, like this is, I'm not exactly the same as my dad, but he, I'm falling like right in step with kind of the big bullet points that I grew up with. So.
Isn't it amazing how you never, you like go with your wife, you meet this girl, you're like, hey, you're kind of hot. I like those way those jeans look on you. And you're like, hey, let's go on a date. You're like, wow, you're actually a really cool person. And then you're like, we should date. And then you're like, I really like you. We should get married. But you're never like, so what's your take on discipline styles? Like, do you believe in spanking or not? Like, how long is a normal timeout? Like, you don't talk about that till you're like, all of a sudden there's this child there. And you're like,
exactly.
Wait, what do you believe? Like, no, we're not doing it that way. And she's like, yes, this is how we're doing it. And you're like, no, I'm not allowing my children, you know.
Yeah, that is one of the things that that's one of the things we love about this podcast, truthfully, is there's this hysterical thing where we all kind of like get into this and you just don't know what you're doing. It's like one of the few things in life, I think, that you do where you willingly enter into something with zero information about how to actually achieve that thing. And there's just
I feel like if Amy and I had that conversation, which makes a lot of sense to have, if you know, like you're saying, like you worry about all these seemingly minute little things that bring you together. And then, but you have no idea where, you know, she stands on X, Y, and Z, the big things. But I mean, I was 21 when Amy and I started dating. Like I would have had no idea how to even answer those questions. And I think she could have asked me at 30 and I'd have no idea. You know what I mean? It's like you just kind of throw yourself in. And I don't even know if you should try to have those conversations early on, you know?
Right.
So just jump in, see what happens.
Matt, this is, we've taken so much of your time. So we end this with two big questions. And that wasn't even one of them. If you thought that was a stinger, just buckle up for these two. So I'll ask you one. I'll let John ask the other one. So I'll ask the first one. What is the one thing you want your kids to know?
I mean that they're loved, I guess. I don't know. Is that overly simple?
No.
Yeah. Regardless of what they do or what they, where they go, you know, that they, as they are created and who they are made to be, they are loved, I guess, would be my goal.
I love that. It's amazing. That sounds really simple, but I do think that is unbelievably profound. I think if someone, I think that's the one of the greatest gifts my parents gave me, genuinely, was that I never, ever doubted that.
Well, I think what's really important, what you added, is that they are loved as they are, which is a really important.
Okay, so that's not, sorry, so that's different from my childhood. There was, sorry, I should have, damn it. Okay, so I rescind that.
You are loved as long as.
Yes.
And then a long list that I had memorized.
Subtle difference.
A little song I sang to make it, so I knew it.
Some hand signals.
Oh my God.
You are loved if you do.
No ponytails, earrings, tattoos on your forehead.
No cigarette.
Oh my God. Clap, 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 clap.
Okay. Last question. What do you want your kids to say at your funeral?
God, seriously? This is not a real question. I mean, what is your deepest fear, John?
What's the worst thing you've ever done?
Yeah. Are there any felonies in your life that no one knows about? What do I want them to say about me?
Mm-hmm. At your funeral.
I would like them to say that he loved people well around him, hopefully majoring in their mom.
That's great.
Is that the same answer? I'm giving you the Pinterest quote for the.
I wish that's what we're looking for.
We laugh like I mean, no we edit watching. These down to about 5 minutes. So that's what we need. You know what I do want to say, though, honestly?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, that's hard, right? I don't.
Yeah.
But it's like, try to be a good friend. Something I'm working on every day. Mm. Loving people well.
Mm. Yeah.
And was a multi-platinum selling.
Oh, my gosh. Start back at the top. 1.6 million albums sold.
You're like, well, I'd like for them to just read that sheet. We'll update it, but.
Oh, my gosh.
You are, though, I will say. You are a dad that is, I love seeing you around the neighborhood. You're always with Olive and now, you know, you're always with your kids. I think you should know that. Like, you should know that you are seen as a great dad. Like, people, whether they know who you are or not, I think, you know, our little neighborhood here, you know, we're all, like we said at the beginning, we're all just a couple blocks away from each other right now in the same neighborhood. You see people around the neighborhood that you just know from the neighborhood. And you're one of those guys where it's like, he seems like a good dad. He's always with his kids, always hanging, always with slightly clashing colors.
Yeah, that he's like a version of Kermit the Frog that gets lighter as you go down his legs on the torso.
He's like a version of Kermit the Frog that's he's been standing in waist deep water all day.
Matt, thank you so much for doing this.
Yes, this was so great. Thank you.
My pleasure, man. I was incredibly nervous. You know.
Well, you stuck it. If the you three and you needs to hear it, you killed it. You delivered. You achieved.
I achieved. Man, I appreciate you guys. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, good day to you. It's Joel with the King Country dropping in to let you know that our brand new film, Unsung Hero, is in theaters now.
It's Luke here. We've teamed up with the creators of Jesus Revolution to bring you this adventure of a lifetime. It's a powerful, true story about a family uniting, growing in their faith, and facing the impossible together.
In theaters now, unsunghero.movie for more information.
Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested.